G'day, and thanks for joining us for this week's Two Ticks Town Talk, a segment of the Australia Talks podcast. I'm DK.
And I'm RD.
Please enjoy this segment from the regular podcast.
All right, Two Ticks Town Talk this week is Zehan. Z-E-E-H-A-N in Tasmania. It's a small town on the west coast of Tassie. It's about a third way down from the top. Got a population of 702. The Greater Zehan area was inhabited by the indigenous Pirapa and Tomajini clans of the Northwest group for over 10,000 years prior to British getting down into Tassie. They were mainly coastal people. They resided in small numbers on a diet consisting of mutton birds, seals, swan eggs, and eucalyptus gunnii, and constructed bark huts when the westerlies were up there and it was rainy and icy. Now, as an aside, have you ever eaten mutton bird?
No, I haven't.
It was the fishiest smelling household invasive thing that I have ever cooked in my entire life.
Really?
I saw it at the butchers once. They had they sold them frozen mutton birds. I thought, oh, mutton birds. I'd love to try that. Oh, God. I looked up a recipe and I think, oh, that's that's a pretty strong smell. And as soon as the heat got into it and it started opening it up, I was opening the windows. My wife, who she has an allergy to seafood, so she's not keen on seafood at all, came in. What the hell are you doing? Hey, look, I like pungent things, but no, I had two of them. The second one, I cooked it outside, just far away from the house, out in the open. Now, look, I don't know whether it just happened to be something seasonal or that, but I tell you what, it's ticked off the list for me. So, yeah, just blew me away. I've never smelled a fishier smell like that. Good luck to the Pirapa and Tomajini clans. They could enjoy those mutton birds. In the circumnavigation of Tassie between 1798 and 99, George Bass and Matthew Flinders named two of the mountains in the Heemskerk Ranges, Mount Heemskerk and Mount Zehan. And Zehan is apparently Old Dutch for sea rooster, which was in honor of Tasman's voyage of exploration. That was after two of his ships. Now, being in Australia, what do you think was discovered at Zehan that led to a boom?
I'm going to say probably gold.
Ha! You fell into my trap. Australia's often known for gold rushes, but tin, silver, and lead were what was discovered near Zehan. So this is one of the things I thought, oh, this is interesting. I mean,
I was thinking, I was like, Tassie's not really known for its gold rush compared to other parts in Australia, but the west coast of Tasmania is definitely known for its timber. So I was like, oh, maybe it's
Yeah, look, it was a deliberate question because we have so many things of gold rushes featuring as a theme. So we've heard numerous times in our Two Ticks Town Talks, we see a rush of people and money into an area where discoveries have been made and then a decline once the resources are exhausted. Zehan's no exception. I thought it was just interesting how big and up and down it was. So tin was discovered at 1871, and then silver and lead were discovered in the area in 82, a few years later, 10 years later. Post office opened on August 1988, and 1980 it was actually named the township of Zehan as it expanded.
1988?
Yeah, 1888.
Sorry, I was like, wow, that's really new.
Yeah, no. Sorry, my mistake. 1888. The population in 1910 in Zeehan peaked at 10,000. So we're down to 702. So that's a huge.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a massive.
Yeah. And look, here were a couple of things I thought were interesting. During the peak period for mining, which was up to the First World War, there are 159 companies operating in the town.
Wow.
The town had its own stock exchange with 60 members. Yeah. And the main street was over 3.2 kilometers long, two miles in the old money. It had 20 hotels on there, several pubs, a hospital, two theaters. Had a rivalry with Queenstown, which is a nearby town. But during the boom, Zeehan was known as the Silver City. And in the first decade of the 20th century, it was the third largest town in Tasmania.
Wow.
After Hobart and Launceston. Yeah. So that was.
All from grace. Oh, my exactly. goodness.
Yeah. So look, the tin is still, and I think there's copper as well. Tin is still a big part because, I mean, tin is quite a green metal in terms of most of its, I think over half of it is used for solder to replace the old lead solder and then also for tin plating and tins and that. So, yeah, it's one of those unsexy metals, but it's a big part of the Green Revolution.
Yeah, it doesn't get as much love as it probably should.
No, it doesn't. Unfortunately, all that mining, there's pollution issues. So there was, they did a study in 2021. There was lead, copper, cadmium, and arsenic contamination equivalent to the most severely polluted lakes in the world. There'd been a whole lot of out of control open cut mining until the Environmental Protection Act of 73 came in. This I thought interesting. They had recent bushfires, which caused an increase in atmospheric mercury levels to three or four times the pre-industrial level due to the release of mercury that had been locked up in the trees.
Oh, my goodness. Of course.
Well, you read it. Okay, of course, it gets released as well. But, yeah, that sort of blew me away. That was an interesting rise and fall of Zeehan, and look, they have tourism now, but yeah, it's another two ticks town talk that we've seen that up and down. So a little factoid before we get to the thing that really caught my attention here: Zeehan has Tasmania's tallest wind farm. So in 2018, construction began on it was $280 million. The Granville Harbour Wind Farm. The tallest wind farm, but it took Tasmania to 100% renewable energy. And in 2020, it was Australia's best performing wind farm.
So when you say tallest, do you mean like on the highest peak or the towers are the tallest?
I couldn't determine that correctly.
Okay.
So I didn't see anything because I did look at it and I didn't see something that told me why it was the tallest. So,
okay. I'll assume it's the towers because
I would too. Otherwise, it would have been highest. So maybe that's why they don't really sort of didn't make much of a deal on it, just because they thought, tallest is how tall they are.
Yeah.
But here's the unusual bit of information that I didn't know about, which primarily caught my eye about Zeehan. So in the introduction, one of the food sources of the local Pirapa and Tomagini people was Eucalyptus gunnii. So what's so special about that and what was done with it? So here's a question for you. What happens when you have sugar in the presence of yeast?
It ferments.
Yep.
And you get alcohol.
Exactly. So a common name for eucalypt gunnii is cider gum. And one thing I didn't know about before this is Aboriginal fermentation.
I'd never even thought about it. Oh, my goodness.
Exactly. So the local Pirapa and Tomagini people around the area, now known as Zeehan, they use the sap of the tree to produce a fermented beverage called Wayalina. I believe other indigenous people in other areas of Tassie might also have used the tree for similar purposes, but this was particularly focused on those clans around Zeehan. So while the oil from the leaves of the cider gum can be used as an antiseptic and to treat migraines, the sap is where the fermentation magic happens. And this is from an article in The Conversation. In the past, Aboriginal people tapped the trees to allow the sap, resembling maple syrup, to collect in hollows in the bark or at the base of the tree. Ever-present yeast would ferment the liquid into an alcoholic, cider-like beverage that the local Aboriginal people referred to as Wayalina. And the practice was even, unsurprisingly, the practice was adopted by the European settlers, such that when the species was described in 1844 for the first time by the British botanist Sir Joseph Dalton Hooker, it was already known as the cider tree or the cider gum. So it's not surprising.
That's cool.
Isn't it? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's really cool. I love that.
Yes, so do I. It's just one of those things as you're looking around for the towns and so you say, oh, hang on, tick Aboriginal fermentation. Why have I never heard of that? Look, in some ways, it's not surprising the Aboriginal people are already aware of the fermentation process to make these beverages. It's occurred in many other cultures around the world, and that's happened for millennia. And yeah, they're an old race of people. So
making bloody bush cider, that would be me. I would be that guy that would be like, this is my job. I'll go do this.
And you can imagine the settlers coming out and sort of saying, what are you doing? And they have a bit of a taste. I assume it was friendly enough. Actually, that's possibly an incorrect thing. But looking at it and saying, you're kidding me, I can get that out of a tree?
Yeah.
Imagine them going a bit berserk. I sort of tried to dig a little bit more. I found it surprising that there has not been a whole lot of as much study done as I would have expected on the fermentation amongst Aboriginal people. There's a couple of works by a social anthropologist. She was called Maggie Brady, published one in 2018 and one 2014. I didn't purchase them or work out how to borrow them for the library, but they were referenced in an article in The Conversation by a bloke, Professor Vladimir Jeronik, who's a professor of oenology at the University of Adelaide. And oenology is the science and study of wine and wine production. So he's currently studying the subject. He's wanting to sort of get into the nitty-gritty of it. So in the sap, he found sugars like glucose and fructose and maltose, as well as some organic acids and alcohol. So yeah, sounds like a very rich substance. He was also interested in the fungal species present, yeast being a microfungi. But there hasn't been anything conclusive or particularly revelatory at this stage about what he's got in there. So it was one of those, wow, look at this. And then when I tried to dig into it a bit more, it was sort of like, oh, it's still getting studied. But I loved it so much, I thought I've got to bring that to the table. So look, who knows what future studies will show. But at this point, I thank the township of Zeehan in Tasmania for leading me down another Two Ticks Town Talk interesting path.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. I want to try it. I want to try this bush cider because I'm a brewer. Our regular listeners will probably remember that I make my own beer and spirits as well. And yeast is such a funny bunch of creatures because there's wild yeast basically everywhere. And I brew in the same spot in my house. Basically, every time I put a brew on, it's in the same place. And I've noticed in the past, quite often, I'll mix up the fermentable sugars and things like that into the water before I'll put the yeast in just to let it cool down and settle and everything like that. And quite often I have found that fermentation has already begun before I've put the yeast in, just because of the yeast out of the air, and possibly because as I dump it in, it's very likely it's a strain of the yeast that I, because I normally use the same strain, it's very likely a version of that yeast, because I do it in the same spot. It's sort of in my house, so it's a closed, well, relatively closed environment. And it's yeast is one of these things that you can basically never get rid of. It's always, you know, just around everywhere in the world, sort of thing. So I'm sure they probably had, and they probably had like their favorite tree, you know, because the little tiny area that particular yeast strain, or because yeast obviously mutates and things quite regularly. So there are so many different strains, thousands and thousands of different strains of yeast. And they do different flavors. So the beers that you enjoy, different yeasts create different flavors in the product, the end product as well. So quite often you'll find brewers will search to the ends of the earth to find specific strains of yeast that they like because they want certain flavors. So I wonder...
I didn't know that. I didn't know that the yeast had such an impact on the flavor.
It's probably, it's definitely one of the biggest things. And I would wonder if there were, you know, some of these guys very, you know, protected these trees because they loved the flavors or whatever that came off it, off, you know, this certain area, this is mine, leave it alone, you know, sort of thing. This is DK's special brew tree. But again, probably a lot of that sort of knowledge, unfortunately, has been lost over the years. But I can imagine in my head that some of this sort of stuff would have been going on at some point. So, how cool. I had no idea. How cool.
Nor did I. I thought, given your interest, I thought you'd also be interested in that. But it's I love finding these things out.
Because the only... When I was in Hobart many, many years ago, I went to there's a distillery in Hobart called the Lark Distillery, like the bird.
They make a nice whiskey.
They make a very good whiskey. And at the time, they also had I think it was a fairly limited run. They called it Bush Vodka. And I was like, what do you mean Bush Vodka? And I was like, are you moonshining or something like that? And he's like, no, it tastes like the bush. And I was like, what? And it did. It tasted like the smell of the bush. It had sort of eucalyptusy undertones and these florally scents. And I wouldn't say it was like, I didn't buy a bottle, let's say that. It wasn't unpleasant, but it definitely wasn't something I would... But I'm glad I tried it, and it was very unique, and I was like, oh. And I wonder now if they took a little bit of inspiration, perhaps, from some of this. So maybe not.
Who knows?